May it please the court, my name is James Bailey. I appear today on behalf of the appellant, Pat Mitchell. My registration number is 22994. I believe that the briefs in this case clearly establish most of the issues. I'm only going to highlight some of the points which I believe require clarification and take any questions that the court has. There are four areas with my limited time that I intend to focus in on today. The first area relates to child support, and there's two sub-issues. The first one is the respondent, Mr. Merrick's income. The second issue relates to child support, and this is the children's needs analysis. The third issue relates to the trial court's denial of a reimbursement expense between the party. And finally, to keep up the theme of this afternoon, I'm going to touch on attorney's fees. First, as it relates to child support in this case, there is no adequate finding as it relates to the trial court's determination of Mr. Merrick's income. The trial court found, and I quote, respondent can earn or make $600,000 a year, and that petitioner can earn $150,000 or an 80-20 split. We profoundly disagree with this determination. There were four hotly contested legal and factual issues which were tended to the trial court as it relates to Mr. Merrick's income. First among those is, what is his actual income?
Excuse me, counsel, I apologize for interrupting you.
No problem.
I just wanted to remind you and your adversary that some of the briefs here were filed under seal. I assume that is to protect the party's financial circumstances. And these arguments are available on the internet, so I only, and which is not something we have any control over, so I can only encourage you to be somewhat circumspect when you start throwing around actual numbers.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
That goes for both of you.
And then let me speak with some care as I approach this issue, because we asserted that Mr. Merrick's income substantially exceeded that amount, and as it relates to the actual number itself, the evidence, I think, is unrefuted that it substantially exceeds that amount. Mr. Merrick had argued to the trial court that his income should be reduced for four reasons. One is, he said, we have to reduce my income by 25% because I work 2,700 hours a month. That's what he bills. That's an extraordinary amount. And he analogized to the child support statute and said that's just like voluntary overtime. Two, Mr. Merrick had argued that his income should properly be averaged over a course of years, and if you look at the record, his income has changed over the course of the years. Three, he urged that his income that flowed through from a closely held corporation should be excluded from his income because it was received only to pay further taxes with. And finally, we need clarification on what his investment or dividend income is. And just stop here. Look at the trial court's order. It doesn't address any of those issues. There is no finding from this trial court from which we can determine how this court made a determination of Mr. Merrick's issue. It did not resolve any of those four key issues. Mr. Merrick, in his briefing here, has suggested that the trial court reduced his income by 25%, added back the C-spine income, and then averaged that over a course of years. But we don't know that's true. It's not in the findings of the court. And clearly, going back to the word can, we stop. It seems as though the trial court here is making a determination of potential income. We are therefore, at a minimum, requesting that this court reverse and remand for further findings so that we know how the trial court came up with Mr. Merrick's income. But as equally important is, we want some direction from this court to the trial court on each of those components. Specifically, as it relates to the question of what has been characterized as voluntary overtime, at the time Mr. Merrick filed his statute, the law in Colorado provided that income from a secondary job in excess of 40 hours per week could not be added back to wage income. That law does not apply to this case. There is no voluntary overtime component because Mr. Merrick's income is pass-through income from a closely held corporation. That is his law entity, Merrick and Associates. That is the sole source of his income. And the legislature did not have a voluntary overtime provision as it relates to that statute. They knew how to do it because they did it as it's associated with wages, but they didn't do it in this case. If you take a moment to compare those two different components of the statute, it's very clear that all pass-through income should be construed as income for child support purposes.
Well, you characterize it as pass-through income. Is that because the evidence showed that Mr. Merrick receives a markup essentially on associates who are working for him? Or is the income that's passed through essentially the bill, the average rate times his $2,700 less his expenses?
The income, because it's from a closely held corporation, is gross receipts minus ordinary and necessary expenses, and it just gives you a bottom line number, which is net income. I'm mischaracterizing that as passive or pass-through income, because even if it's retained within the corporation itself and not distributed out, it still, under the statute, is considered to be income for child support purposes.
My question was a little different.
I'm sorry.
It was probably ill-phrased. Is that income somebody else's, or is that income derived from his $2,700 a year?
It is. There is no evidence in the record that breaks down what is the source of that income. It is income which is derived from all sources, including both his time and any profit that he would make off of associate time or paralegal time.
And was there evidence in the record that there are associates and paralegals working in the firm?
There is evidence in the record that there are associates with the firm. At a minimum, it's contained within the profit and loss exhibits, the net income statements. As I recall, a line for salary. If I'm wrong, I'm sure Mr. Merrick will correct me, but okay. I think that's correct.
Thank you.
And we also think there's a case that's right on point. I've cited it in the briefs. It's In Re Marriage of Upson. And it talks about whether or not you would have a voluntary overtime component added to income from a closely held corporation. The Upson citation is 991 Pacific 2nd 341. The next question relates to whether or not it would be appropriate to average Mr. Merrick's income. And here we submit that it's not. And we admit that there's some discretion which is given to the trial court. But here, there's only 1 year where he has this pass-through income from his closely held corporation. Prior to that, he was with a different employer. And the second thing we would note is we don't believe that there's a fluctuation in his income, because his income steps up and increases every year that we can possibly trace back. And therefore, we would suggest that there's not a fluctuation, but an increasing in the income. An analogy would be this. Someone earns $8 an hour, $9 an hour, $10 an hour. We don't average their income back to $8 because it's gone up consistently every year. To the contrary, we say in every circumstance that the child support income determination is based off of the actual income of the parent at the time of the trial.
Well, is it your hourly wage earner analogy, though, somewhat inapt in that unless the hourly wage earner gets demoted for misconduct, he's never going to go back to $8 an hour, whereas a lawyer may make X dollars in year one and Y dollars in year two because a big client goes bankrupt, et cetera. So I mean, isn't there a greater potential of going down with the lawyer than there is with the hourly wage earner who, like under a union contract, just gets seniority increases?
There is greater potential for that. But under the facts of this case, there is nothing that would show that other than speculation. What I'm trying is not to make an analogy to the contractual nature of the relationship, but an analogy to the fact that his income is increasing two or threefold during this time frame, and that his business, the place that he is working, is also changing. He goes from the San Visciano firm into his own private practice, and you really see a corresponding jump in his income.
Okay.
I'd also like to address the pass-through income from C-Spine, which was, as I recall, $116,000 at the time of trial. C-Spine is a closely held corporation. Mr. Merrick argued to the trial court that the only actual cash he receives from C-Spine is the money that is necessary for him to pay the income taxes on the pass-through income to him. And therefore, he says that the net benefit to him is zero. We should exclude it from child support. With all due respect, that's contrary to Colorado law. Colorado law says income from a closely held corporation passes through, it's captured within child support. The fact that income is taxed is not relevant to the child support calculation. Then there is a case that addresses this issue, In Re Marriage of Bond, 8 Pacific 3rd, 539. That's actually a lottery case where husband came in and said, you have to take the net amount of my lottery winnings after taxes when you determine what my income is. Court of Appeals said, no, it's actual gross income is the income that we used for child support. Finally, the trial court, when it entered its $600,000 number, never broke it down into capital gains, never broke out the interest or the dividend income, which is significant in this case, because Mr. Merrick's savings increased by a significant number during this relevant time period. And thus, the amount that that is going to generate is substantial.
Okay, on these issues, you're not asking for the opportunity to reopen the evidence. You just want us to vacate the order and remand for specific findings, correct?
Yes. On this issue, I'm merely asking for you to vacate and remand for specific findings with directions on these four areas so that the trial court has some guidance. We can then determine, and you can almost, as a matter of law, determine what the income is and just remand with directions to enter that amount. I don't think there's any dispute once the legal issue is solved. The next issue relates to the child support needs of both children, and this briefly touches upon Mr. Merrick's appeal. Before the trial court, we urged that the children's needs exceeded the amount that was set forth in the statutory guidelines. The court is, of course, aware that where the incomes go above the guidelines, the guidelines set forth the, quote, minimum presumptive amount. And what the trial court must do then is to determine child support based off of the needs. If there's no evidence as to those needs, then the trial court should enter the minimum presumptive amount as the child support award. And that clearly defines the two children in this case. We spent some time in this case, and we very carefully went through what are McKenzie's needs, and we established a need threshold of $5,000 a month. Mr. Merrick did not. As he approached Cameron's needs, he said, this is merely the presumptive amount. The trial court in this case did not set child support based on needs. The trial court set its child support award based purely off of the incomes of the parties. He said in passing, I'm a supply side kind of guy. That is clearly an abuse of discretion. We've done a string cite of cases for the court to consider.
Again, is this an issue where a remand for findings is appropriate? You're not asking for a chance to put on more evidence?
I don't believe. We may have to have more evidence based off of subsequent facts, but we would specifically request the opportunity for findings. I'm always reluctant to do that. They shift judges in the Denver District Court every year, and you are never certain about whether or not the judge wants a refresh on the evidence that's presented.
As of the present, has either or both of these children achieved the age of majority, 19?
There's an issue that's presented which would say that, yes, McKenzie has emancipated under the court's order because she has now left for college. Right now, there is a trust that is paying for her needs, and we have urging that the age of emancipation issue, which is tendered in the briefs, it's now moot. But yes, there's still one child, Cameron, who still has needs.
And has not yet reached the age of emancipation.
He has not reached the age of maturity.
I
would reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'll address the issues in the same order that Mr. Bailey articulated them with respect to his argument. First, the issue is father's income. The court found, and Mr. Bailey quibbles with the vocabulary of the trial court, but found that father's income was $600,000 annually. Mr. Bailey argues that the trial court failed to make findings justifying the $600,000. What the rules require is that the trial court make findings and that the evidence support the findings. In fact, the trial court did make findings. It found, as a matter of fact, that father's income was $600,000. The question is whether or not the evidence supports the trial court's findings. The evidence at trial was that there was a certain income that was derived by father as a result of working extraordinary hours as a result of an effort to try and retire early. That there was a voluntary, intentional effort to put in extraordinary hours in an effort to retire early. The argument was made to the trial court, and the trial court commented on that and said, certainly, it does appear that father is working extraordinary hours in a way that would be more than full-time employment. There was a specific comment by the trial court with respect to that. Therefore, the trial court was entitled under, and the statutory codification has changed, so I'm going to make reference here to the site that would be appropriate under the version the trial court was using. It's 14-10-115(5)(a)(2)(i)(c), which provides that income which is the result of earnings which are more than full-time employment are to be excluded from income. The trial court found that at 2,700 hours per year billable, that was 25% more than full-time employment. That is, at best, a conservative determination by the trial court, and we submit the evidence does support the trial court's finding. Secondly, the trial court had evidence before it, and by the way, that money that was referred to in the evidence that supported the trial court's finding included passive as well as actual earned income. So the argument with respect to passive income, interest, dividends, and the like, is captured within the evidence that was before the trial court, which supports the trial court's finding. Secondly, the trial court adopted an income averaging approach to father's income. With respect to the evidence that was before the trial court, the evidence before the trial court was the trial court was confronted with a law practice which at the beginning of the evidence had not been in existence more than 1 year. It had been in existence less than 1 year. And following, and at the time of the final hearing below, the law firm had been in existence slightly over 1 year. The evidence was that the income depended on a variety of factors which the trial court heard about, including the ability to track clients, the ability to cause clients to pay the bankruptcy filings, the awards by trial courts with respect to fees that are awardable by the trial court, and so on. Based on the uncertainty of income with respect to a nascent law firm, the trial court determined that income averaging was appropriate and was consistent with this court's ruling in Marriage of Rice and Fouch, which is found at 987 Pacific 2nd, 947, particularly at page 950. Thirdly, the trial court considered the issue of income from a closely held corporation where father is not in management. He is simply he's a holder of a tiny percentage of a company, which is a sub-S company. The evidence before the trial court was undisputed that the only monies ever received by father as a consequence of his tiny percentage ownership in the sub-S corporation was money which was used exclusively to pay federal and state income taxes. There was not one penny received by father other than with respect to pay federal and state income taxes.
How is that different from the lottery case where the winner apparently said child support only equals net, not gross? That's the 8P 3rd 539. I apologize. I didn't pick up the name.
I believe that the statute, which is in those days then recodified, so forgive me, I'm giving you the 07 cites, 14-10-115, sub 5, sub A, sub 2, provides that closely held income from a closely held corporation includes gross income. And then it has a definition of gross income, which says that gross income does not include amounts allocable by the Internal Revenue Service for accelerated component of depreciation expense or investment as tax credits. In other words, well, the way the statute works is to say that ordinary necessary expenses would include any necessary expenses associated with the company, and we would argue that that would include if father receives nothing other than monies to pay income taxes, to allocate to him shares of money that are used for nothing other than to pay income taxes would be inappropriate. However, even if the court were to reject that argument, it is important to understand what Judge Phillips said, because Judge Phillips said, look, you want me to give you some number, whether it's 500,000, 600,000, or some greater number. It really doesn't matter to me, because what's before me, as Judge Phillips correctly said, was what are the needs of the children? And I don't care whether you're making $80 trillion a year. The question is the needs of the children. And what Judge Phillips said on the evidence before him, and there was ample evidence to support Judge Phillips' conclusion, was that $3,000 a month, $6,000 annually for monthly for two children, more than met the needs of two children who are not in private schooling, with no special needs, with no extraordinary activities, who are just average, normal, everyday kids. $6,000 a month was sufficient.
But the percentage allocation between the mother and father, even if that's the number, will affect how much the net is between the father and the mother, correct?
Judge Richmond, mathematically speaking, your argument is irrefutable. I will point out, however, that the evidence at trial was that mother's income, conceded by opposing counsel in closing argument, was close to 215, was substantially more than the amount of earnings that she was allocated at trial. The trial court allocated to her $150,000.
But if the court were to find 90-10 as opposed to 80-20, it would affect the allocation of the child support, the net payment from father to mother.
It might, but I might also point out that since Mackenzie is now emancipated, that actually works to mother's detriment, because mother is now paying child support to father, okay, because Mackenzie is emancipated, and that allocation will actually work to her financial disadvantage, as bizarre as it sounds. In any event, my point here is that that what Judge Phillips did was to say we can get involved in all sorts of efforts to try and reach mathematical precision, but anybody who's ever been in a trial court knows that's not possible. What you're trying to do is to figure out what the needs of the child are, and that's not going to be mathematically precise, and you need to find out what, roughly speaking, the mathematical contribution of each spouse to the child support should be. Judge Phillips did not accept the mathematically precise allocation on an income averaging. He was above that for father. Judge Phillips was substantially below the evidence with respect to what mother was making.
So it's hard to tell how he arrived at these figures.
Well,
you would agree with that.
I would agree that Chief Judge Phillips did not specify with specificity how he arrived at the mathematical number. However, I don't think that the law requires that, Judge Furman.
But his order is based upon the percentage percentage allocation. We have to figure that out before we can determine. I'm confused by your argument. I'll just have to say I don't understand.
Okay.
I mean, the percentage you agreed with Judge Richmond would be affected.
It is true that depending on whether or not the numbers shift, the allocation of child support between the parents will change.
Okay.
That is not the issue I respectfully submit. The issue is whether or not Chief Judge Phillips' determination as to the numbers is supported by the evidence. Is Judge Phillips within the range of reason with respect to the evidence that was provided? Is it reasonable for Judge Phillips to conclude, not mathematically precisely, but is it within the range of reason for Judge Phillips to conclude that father's income was $600,000, which would be above what the average number would be? Is it within the rule of reason for Judge Phillips to conclude that based on the evidence, mother's income was $150,000? Don't believe that it has to be mathematically precise, but the court has to ask itself, did the evidence support that in a reasonable way? Secondly, Mr. Bailey argued that Judge Phillips did not take the children's needs into consideration. To the contrary, the evidence was exclusively that he did take the needs into consideration. Judge Phillips heard the evidence from mother, which said that Mackenzie was requiring over $5,000, $5,200 per month for a child that has no special needs, no private education, no extraordinary activities. She got to that number by providing that number comes from renovation of her home, extensive landscaping at her home, purchase of a second automobile. Judge Phillips rejected that testimony, as he was entitled to do, because it was not manifestly unreasonable. There was no clear.
Does the transcript reflect that, or are you inferring that from his ultimate findings?
I'm inferring that from the ultimate findings. But Judge Phillips did hear the evidence, and what he said was, based on the evidence here, what he specifically says is no more than $3,000 a month is required, and with mother coming in at $5,200 a month on Mackenzie alone, I think that it's fair to say that he rejected that testimony. With respect to, and I want to address only briefly, because I have only a few moments, address briefly the argument that Judge Phillips was required to extrapolate above the maximums in the statutory guidelines. Chief Judge Phillips was faced with a record where the Denver trial court had three times previously declined to extrapolate above the maximums in the child support table. Judge Phillips found no basis, issued no findings which would justify setting a child support number above the statutory maximums in the child support statute. This court and other courts have held that in order, and particularly the Upson court, in order for the trial court to extrapolate above the statutory guidelines, there must be specific findings of fact warranting the increase in child support above the statutory maximums. Here, Judge Phillips issued no such findings. In fact, Judge Phillips found no extraordinary basis for doing so here. The judge was not required to extrapolate above it, and I would point out that with respect to McKenzie, it's sort of like what he did with respect to McKenzie. What Judge Phillips essentially did was to say, the statute provides a rebuttable presumption, 1410.115, subsection 8. I am going to find that because McKenzie's needs are being met by an educational trust, which pays both for her education as well as her living expenses, that McKenzie is emancipated for purposes of the statute when she leaves for college. In this particular case, Judge Phillips made no findings with respect to the need to extrapolate above the child support maximums. In that case, Judge Phillips should have, at most, adopted the maximum in the statutory child support table. That would require this court to reverse and remand with directions to Judge Phillips that he should enter a statutory amount no greater than the statutory maximums. No additional evidence required.
Does he have discretion to make the findings now that there's basis to go above the statutory maximum based on the evidence he heard?
Based on the evidence he heard, there is no evidence to do so. I'm not going to say that Judge Phillips could not do that, but I would say that any such finding would be manifestly without support in the evidence with respect to the children's needs.
Well, he rejected the mother's $5,200 number, but he settled at $3,000. That doesn't mean he rejected everything she was asking for. Taking your analysis.
Mother, you'd have to look at the evidence, and with respect, Judge Richmond, the evidence was, mother's testimony was general, to say the least. It was, well, of course, it's got to be this and this and this, but if you look at what the evidence that she supplied, the evidence was, well, I have renovated my home. I need additional money. Well, I've got extensive landscaping at my home. I need additional money. Meanwhile, the children are living with father. So Judge Phillips, I think, found exactly what the trial court had found three previous times before, and that mother was using the request for increase in child support as a basis for funding a lifestyle that is in excess of her earning capacity. Finally, I want to address the, well, I see I'm out of time. Thank you for your time.
Several points I believe require clarification here. First of all, let me make it very clear. Every time, I think that Mr. Merrick was saying that Judge Phillips found or Judge Phillips determined, I think he's inferring that from the record. The order in this case is one page long. The sentences that we're talking about have no such finding. There's been no such determination. And so every time, and this is directed to Judge Richmond, when you're speaking about that, whether or not the trial court rejected mother's testimony, the trial court didn't do that. The trial court made it very clear. I'm a supply-side kind of guy. He says, and I'm going to quote from volume 14, pages 135, 126. He says, I'm going to base the decision that I need to make based upon what I think a reasonable expense for a child is, plus special needs. That's not the law. This is a particularized determination once you go above the child support standards. And the briefing makes it clear he didn't do that. He said a reasonable child, I'm going to peg a number. That's what he did for Mr. Merrick's number. Reasonable attorney, I'm going to peg a number. What he did with relation to Cameron, reasonable, I'm going to peg a number. Mr. Merrick is correct. There's no needs evidence as it relates to Cameron. that number has to be the 268 number that he sets forth in his briefs. But as it relates to McKenzie, the trial court has to base its determination on her needs, which, by the way, can include renovation of the house, the landscaping costs. Having a child is a tremendously expensive determination, and it's a thing that is not simply food and clothing. It's the mortgage. One of the things that the briefing, and there's evidence to back this up, shows it's the car. Mr. Merrick offered the children a car, and that played a role in their parenting time determinations in this case. The purpose of the child support guideline is to equalize that. It's the same purpose that's served by the attorney's fees award in this case. It is, and it's made express in the cases that touch upon this, it is to equalize the parties' financial circumstances and their playing field. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. Perhaps it was appropriate that the day end on a reference to attorney fees. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course. That completes our docket. And